Welcome to the Mind Money Spectrum podcast, where your hosts, Aaron Ogti and Trishul Patel, go beyond traditional finance questions to help you explore how to use your money to achieve the freedom you want in life.
In this episode, Trishul and Aaron dig into universal basic income. Income inequality is a problem in the United States, and UBI, or a negative income tax, may be a potential solution. But how does UBI fit in with a capitalist system? And how might it affect incentives for people at different levels of income? If the US already provides a variety of social safety nets, moving to a UBI has the potential to increase efficiency and reduce bureaucracy. UBI can be revenue neutral, and it might even reduce overall government spending. But more study is needed. As automation displaces workers and careers, UBI could be the bridge to advance society to the next level. And now, on to our conversation.
Hi, my name is Aaron Ogti. I'm a financial advisor in the Bay Area. I'm here with Trishul Patel, a wealth manager on the East Coast.
Hey, Aaron, great to be here today, and thanks everybody for listening.
Great to be here as well. So one of the themes that we've talked about in the past when it comes to things like healthcare costs, education costs, and real estate or housing costs is that those have been going up at a rate greater than inflation. Those three costs in particular have been increasing faster than inflation. And that's one of the things that Trishul's mentioned is that that means I've also been increasing as a percentage of household income. And part of Trishul's point is that these can't keep going up forever. You can't be paying 100% of your household income to housing and then also 100% of your household income to healthcare and then also 100% of your income to education. So there has to be some kind of leveling off point where just market effects and societal and population effects just don't keep increasing those costs. But one of the premises of that that I mentioned kind of each time is that they are increasing as a percentage of household income in a big part because over the last generation or so, wages have only been increasing with inflation. So those three costs, housing, healthcare, and education, have been increasing greater than inflation. Wages have only been increasing with inflation. And that's why those are making up a larger percentage of household income. And that can't keep going on forever. So one of the possibilities is that those costs don't increase greater than inflation, that they reach some leveling off point. Another idea is that could we get wages to increase faster than inflation? And now if we could get wages increasing faster than those three costs are increasing, you could actually see those three costs making up less of a percentage of household income. And we don't have any solutions for that, but we want to discuss some of the ideas that we've kind of been dancing around. And one of those is universal basic income, or UBI. So, Trishul, do you mind giving us a primer, a quick discussion, a quick explanation of what is universal basic income? And then maybe we can discuss why that might help in these situations.
Yeah, happy to. And where I would probably begin is the notion is quite simple. No matter who you are or what your position is, you get a paycheck every month for being a citizen of the United States. That's basically it. You get a paycheck. And you get this from the moment you're born until the moment you die. That's quite simply how you might think about it. Now, the notion probably began quite some time ago from a different perspective, known as something called a negative income tax. This was actually put forward by an economist, Milton Friedman, a long time ago, and he actually won the Nobel Prize in 1976 in economics for a lot of his research, and he was an advisor to the Republican administration for Reagan. And he was also an advisor for Margaret Thatcher in the UK. And he actually held this notion that he believes in the free market and he believes in minimal intervention, but he believed in this notion of a negative income tax. And let me explain that before I talk about UBI. Negative income tax is just the notion that once your income starts to drop, instead of the taxes you pay going to zero, they actually become negative, such that below a certain threshold, the government starts paying you until you have zero income, at which point you have something to support you. And that's very similar to a universal basic income. And I'll talk about the nuances later in this episode. But before we get into more details on all of that, I also want to talk about the actual problem of why something like this would make sense. But to begin, you know, that's as simple as I can put the definition of UBI.
Okay, so when you think of the problem, is this kind of U.S. specific? I'm a little curious to see the description of the problem and how that might compare to other societies and cultures, and then why UBI might help.
Right. The problem, as I see it, stems from this notion of income inequality. As you had mentioned, the wages for the median individual in the U.S. have not really increased once you compensate for inflation, meaning the spending power for an individual in the late 70s is about the same as what it is in the 2010s. And that's for the median case. But if you break this down into different buckets, meaning, you know, like the lowest 20% versus the top 20%, things look a lot different. The lowest 20% of earners are actually earning less these days than they did in the late 70s, if you adjust for inflation. And the top 20%, though, they're actually earning about 50% more adjusted for inflation. So things have gotten better for the top and worse for the lower group of individuals. And about the people in the middle, as we've said, they're about the same, maybe a little better, maybe a little worse. But that's the bigger picture of what's happened in the U.S. Now, I want to balance that against a few things. One, as you had mentioned, there's other places in the world where this has been an issue and a concern, but not necessarily true with other countries that have a more balanced view on providing a social support system. And in those countries, we've mentioned some of these, and you've probably heard of these. Scandinavian countries have done a good job with keeping income inequality under control. But in the U.S., it's one of those situations where it's quite the opposite. The other thing I want to throw in there to balance this is we mentioned that for the median case, the average income is about the same or just up a little bit. But there's two key points to add into that. One, with the average household, a big thing changed in the last generation. Now we have more than one person typically working. We have a husband and wife pursuing income. So you add that in, and the fact that people tend to be working longer hours and taking less vacations, all of that combined is still baked into these numbers where incomes still haven't been rising that much in the median case. So if you back that out, then it's even worse than it sounds. So keeping that in mind, and then one other thing to keep in mind is I mentioned that the top 20%, their incomes have grown above inflation by about 50%, meaning if you made $100,000 in the late 70s, you'd be making $1,970 adjusted for today, about $150,000 today, which is good, you know, making more. But here's how it looks if you look finer into that segment. If you look at the top 5% of individuals, they're actually making double what they used to a generation ago, adjusted for inflation. Top 1% of individuals, they're making 180% more, far more than double. The top 1/10 of 1%, so this is 1 in 1,000, they're making 400% more than they used to a generation ago. And then you take the top 1/100th of 1%, they're making 700% more than they used to a generation ago. So there's been a tremendous amount of wealth creation, but it's not being distributed evenly across the board. And what this leads to is a vicious cycle where the more money you have, the more you get, the more you get, the more money you have, and so on. And then on the flip side, the less you have, the less you get, and so on. And this can have pretty critical, profound impacts to society and can also lead to some ridiculousness, as we mentioned, where you can have the median case family having to spend most of their income just on housing, education, and healthcare. So that's the big problem as I see it.
So clarifying a few things. One, you said the really, really top percentiles are seeing their incomes go up. Do you happen to know if that's because their wealth and capital assets are generating income for them? Or is this actually their jobs or their kind of whatever they define as their primary income or primary job has gone up as well?
Right. I don't have those numbers at my fingertips, but I certainly surmise that it's the former, the notion that their wealth has been increasing by an exponential rate. And the reason I say this is because there's a big difference between how an income earner is taxed versus how the wealthy are taxed. The wealthy are taxed by this notion of capital gains and dividends taxes, whereas a typical income earner is taxed by their income tax, how much money they earn from their job. And the crazy part is, as a percentage of your growth in wealth, how much value your net worth grows each year, that tax ends up as a percentage base being far lower for people who are wealthy. Mm. Now, you can guess who designed the tax system and who funded it and who came up with these laws, but it definitely benefits the wealthy. And you probably heard this before. Bill Gates and Warren Buffett all say that they pay lower taxes and they should be paying higher taxes, but they're not changing the laws. They're not responsible for that.
Yeah. Okay, so you saw the idea that if I had $1 million in stock or assets that were generating $30,000 a year or $20,000 a year in the 70s, the equity growth has been far outpacing everything else. And so my $1 million is now worth $10 million, generating $200,000 for me. So something like that. Because it does sound like those numbers or those increases really feel like they line up with the equity growth over the last few decades, probably more so than GDP growth.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Basically, the average wage earner has their wages grow at GDP growth or CPI, which is around 2%. And the wealthy have their wages and net growth grow at about the stock market level of growth, which is 6 or 7%. So if you have most of the population who earn little growing at 2 or 3%, and you have the very wealthy growing at 6 or 7%, it leads to this great imbalance, especially if the taxes for the people growing at a 2% wage growth end up being disproportionately higher than those growing at a 6 or 7%. And the concern is basically, for example, the dividend tax rate is lower than the highest income tax rate.
Yeah.
The capital gains tax rate is lower than the highest income tax rate. And also, if you believe in tax deferred growth, meaning you hold on to your investments and you don't sell year over year, you actually pay zero in taxes.
Yeah. So if you don't sell the stock, yeah, you have to have a stock that doesn't yield dividends. But yeah, if you don't sell the stock, you don't pay taxes.
Yeah. Like Berkshire Hathaway, Warren Buffett's company.
Oh, so yeah, they don't issue dividends?
They don't, and for that very reason. You don't have to pay taxes if you never distribute money. You just let it grow within your company. So there's reasons why these large companies are able to accelerate, and there's reasons why large corporations as well are paying a much lower percentage of taxes than they used to pay. It's because they have these types of benefits that aren't afforded to the average wage earner.
Okay. So you mentioned some of the Scandinavian countries have developed a little bit more of the negative income tax programs. And I might be getting this a little wrong, but what the stories I remember was that Alaska has a negative income tax. And I think a lot of those are funded by oil reserves. One of the Scandinavian countries I know in particular, they have a sovereign wealth fund funded by nationally owned oil programs. I believe Alaska is the same, and that allows them to have this negative income tax. And I believe in Alaska's case, they also use it to attract citizens. Just no one wants to live in Alaska, so they use that as a way to attract a population and keep people staying there or living there.
Right. Yeah. It's also subsidized by oil in Alaska.
Okay. So when we're thinking about the kind of income inequality, there's definitely some of the questions about just capitalism in general. And one of the things I do want to make clear, because you and I have had this discussion, I am very much a capitalist because I do feel that aligns the incentives for the greatest number of people to produce more and generate wealth and make more money. And though there's enough good things from society, and we have seen this throughout history, that as societies adopt democracy and capitalism, they tend to go hand in hand, but they're not exactly the same. You see things like infant mortality go down. You see things like education rates and reading writing rates go up, life expectancies go up. And I think there's enough good things from this that at the base level, I am very pro-capitalist, but I do acknowledge that there are some problems, that this is an issue, and I think I'm open to the conversation about universal basic income, because I don't necessarily like the idea of trying to cut off the top, per se. I like to have some kind of limiting factor, whether it's an extremely high tax rate once you get up to some high level of assets or income. But that idea of lifting the bottom does appeal to me. And I'm curious if you can discuss, kind of, not necessarily the logistics, but some of the theory of why UBI could help this income inequality issue.
Right. So I too believe in a capitalist system, and I'm all for the free market deciding things and lowering bureaucracy. The concern is right now in the US, although we think we're following a capitalist model, we're far from that. There are so many social programs designed to combat income inequality that you would think this would be a non-issue. We have, of course, welfare, and we have rent assistance, we have Social Security, and we have Medicare, and we have Medicaid, we have unemployment, we have disability, we have minimum wage laws, we have food stamps. The list just goes on and on. There's tons of programs out there trying to combat this on the one side. And then on the second side, in terms of why we don't really have a capitalist economy, is effectively what we've decided in the US is that you're allowed to buy legislation. Meaning you can throw enough money behind a policy with lobbyists, and you can have corporations act as people, and they can influence how laws are created such that these types of inequality systems can persist over a generation, which can lead to what we've seen. We've seen that wealth has gone in a direction that where if you have more, you end up just earning more. And it comes down to this notion of, how do we tax people fairly? And one notion is you probably don't want a system where the rich just keep getting richer indefinitely and the poor get poorer. It just leads to a society that's imbalanced, and that's where we're at. So that's the concern I see with the current system. It sounds like it's capitalist, but it's just leading to a system where there are a lot of different programs that don't seem to be adding much value. They are helping a lot of people, but clearly the evidence shows that inequality is getting worse. And also that the fact that the way the tax system is currently set up, it's at a point where if you do have more money, you end up getting richer because you can grow your wealth at a higher rate than a normal individual?
So I'm all scared to open this can of worms. I actually agree with all that, but it is more complex than that. And there's a lot of little things that go beyond just tax laws and buying that. There are a lot of networking effects that you'll see these co-founders or founders of companies that are trying to get some kind of capital structure. They have to know someone in the venture capitalist world, and they have to get that introduction. And the founder themselves, they might only be able to try and build a company because their spouse is working and they have health insurance through their spouse. So they can not earn a salary for a year and not have health insurance, not have to be employed for health insurance for a year to try and build this up. And there are enough situations where people can't take that year off to try to build something new. And even if they could, they don't know how to get access to that capital to try and build it larger. It's more than just lobbying and the tax system. There's enough other little things that some of the theories of UBI might be able to help with. So one of my favorite ideas was that if there was universal healthcare, and maybe if there was UBI, so healthcare is no longer tied to your employer, we might see more people try to start new businesses because they can afford to fail. And that's kind of what we need almost as a society. Like we know of 10 new businesses that start, the majority will fail. They won't be around 2 or 3 years later. Some of them might survive, some of them will thrive, but there's this fear of failure because for too many people, for too much of the population, that failure could be devastating to their lives. Like it actually, between lack of health insurance and lack of income or resources, it could actually be fatal to some people. They get sick and they can't go to the hospital, or they do go to the hospital and now they have medical debt that prevents them from trying to do anything else. And this is one of the reasons why we see differences in life expectancies across income distributions. Wealthier people live longer, in part because they have the time and money to make healthier decisions about their lives, but also they have access to healthcare. So I am a little curious, what are some other theories or ideas of why UBI might help that you run across that appeal to you?
The main thing I see is I think it'll eliminate a lot of bureaucracy. Something we've seen, for example, recently with COVID is the government passed a $2 billion or $2 trillion stimulus bundle in a few days. Thousands of pages of legislation just pushed through, where figuring out what all of it means is probably going to take decades. And like you said, there's all of these different inefficiencies baked into legislation in general. So it's fair to assume that's baked into all of this. And then I mentioned all of these different programs that are designed to provide all of these types of safety nets, but each one has another 1,000 pages of legislation associated with them. And then you need people to police them, and you need people to understand and give advice about them and help people navigate them. Basically, you need a second job to figure them all out. So, you know, I mentioned how you can boost GDP by just providing universal health care so people don't have to spend a few days a year figuring out health insurance. Well, how long is somebody going to need to figure out Social Security, Medicaid, you know, the whole list?
Yeah.
It's taxing on an individual to have to spend a quarter of your life trying to figure out how these programs work. When a UBI program, I can write it down on a napkin. The notion is, everybody gets a guaranteed payment. And the reason why that's a lot simpler is you can eliminate these other programs that are so complex and convoluted and need to be updated and need to be rewritten every couple of years and so on. With a UBI, the notion is if something bad happens, you know you're covered, and then you get to decide where you spend the money. And it turns out that can be done quite efficiently because you know if you need to spend the money on health insurance because you have a problem. Or you know you can spend the money on education so that you can transfer to another career. Or you know that you need to stay at home for your kid, or you need to provide them with some sort of daycare so that you can go off and get a better job. And I think that's why economists like Friedman, who again was a free market economist, believed in this type of system of providing minimal bureaucracy, but still providing a way for the market to expand and grow forward. And I think you touched upon a great point, the notion that if you want innovation within a society, having the safety net is a great way to go about it. Because if you're an individual with some good ideas, but your current job is at a place that stifles innovation, you might actually stay at that not so great, crappy job just because you don't have a safety net to take some time off and pursue an entrepreneurial career that could very likely lead to more wealth over time.
So I'm curious how you would respond to some of the counters and arguments against UBI. And one of the examples I think of is just what if people are content to live off of just their UBI, that they are no longer contributing to society. And one of the examples I've seen indirectly is Native American reservations, especially those with casinos. They tend to have enough income that gets distributed across the tribe that they have problems, especially among their youth, of drug and alcohol, that these older teenagers, people in their 20s, they're getting this money coming in. They don't have to do anything for it. That they don't really have as much education, so they don't have the same job prospects. And there's no reason for them to try and earn a job when they're just going to keep receiving this money. And you see they have more problems with drug and alcohol addiction than other parts of society. And I'm curious, what are some of your thoughts of the risks of UBI and why this might still be worth it?
Yeah, that's a very good point. And you bring up perhaps the biggest concern or criticism against UBI. And it's a very valid point. The notion is, yes, if you're getting a basic income, there's no incentive for you to earn more than $25,000 a year. Let's start with that number. And if you can support yourself on that, why would you do anything else? It's a very good point. And I think it comes down to this. With any sort of system, there's always some sort of concern. And it comes down to, well, is that concern going to outweigh the benefits that we see from UBI? If it is, don't do it, right? Obviously. But this is one of those things where we don't know how big that concern is, but we can test it. We can try to figure that out. So I'd say it's one of those things where it shouldn't be a roadblock to considering the idea. And it could very well be true that the percentage of people who decide that 25K is enough is a minority, where the benefits that we see far outweigh that minority concern. It may be the opposite, in which case UBI is a horrible idea and we can trash can it, but at least we tried. At least we looked into it. And I think that's what I might say.
Okay. Do you know anyone who has tested this already? I'm curious.
Yeah, there have been a few pilot programs here and there, and they've shown some benefit. The concern about pilot programs is if somebody knows they're going to get a UBI for a couple of years and then the program's going to end, that's a lot different than they know they're going to get a UBI for the rest of their life. Mm. You're going to act differently. You might take a 3-year vacation, but you might not take a 80-year vacation. So you can see how that there's a bit of a difference there. And a lot of people who realize that, you know, if they reach a certain point, 60, 70,000, they're probably not, you know, the average household income, they're probably not going to say, you know, I don't need all that. I'm going to go back to 25K. So it's something that it can be tried and tested in pilot programs. And it's something that we can explore and do more research about. But I think it certainly doesn't make sense to just stop at the concern and kind of leave it at that.
Okay, that's fair. And what about some of the concerns with inflation? So if you can live off of $2,000 a month, and that includes your rent and your food, but if everyone has that, does rent go up to be a now more expensive? And like, okay, if everyone can afford this type of rent, then the cheapest apartments will still be more expensive than they are now. I'm curious how do you guess, I use the word guess specifically because it's really hard to predict the future of how anything will play out, but what will be your guess of how market forces play out if everyone has a same minimum income?
Right. I think this gets also tied into the notion of how do you even pay for something like this? It just sounds like you got to print a lot of money to get it to work. And actually, it turns out first to tackle that question, and then I'll get to the inflation, you actually don't need to print a lot of money. In fact, it can be something that's revenue neutral for the government pretty easily. And here's how that might work. So first, you start with an average income, let's say $65,000 a year. For that individual, they may pay a 20% tax rate. So they're taking home $52,000. Well, what happens if you give that $65,000 income earner another $25,000 a year, just basic income, they get it no matter what. That $65,000 turns into $90,000 a year. Oh, they're happy. But guess what? We're going to increase that person's taxes to 42%. Now, what does that mean? That means, whoops, you're still taking home the exact same amount you did before, 52K. So all you did is you gave the average person who's earning 65,000 more money and you tax them at a higher rate so that they're back to where they started. Okay, mm-hmm. So that's the first step. The second step is if you earn more than 65K, you'll pay more in taxes as you earn more, to cover the people who earn less than 65K until you earn zero, in which case you have this floor of 25,000. So that's exactly how a simple UBI system might work.
Okay.
So tax rates go up for the people who are earning more than 65,000. If you're at that 65,000 level, you're about the same. And then if you're below, you're gonna be paying less taxes down to an actual income of 25,000 if you're earning nothing. Now, here's a few other benefits I want to throw in there just in case people are too scared of paying more taxes. You don't have to pay taxes for a lot of these other programs that are there now, meaning that money gets shifted to the UBI bucket, meaning the welfare programs. You don't need actually Social Security now because you have a minimum income when you retire. You can maybe offset a lot of your Medicare and Medicaid costs. Your rent assistance programs can disappear. You don't really need food stamps because everybody has money to pay for food now if that's what their highest priority item is, and so on. So a lot of these spending that we're having could actually help subsidize this potential increase in taxes for people earning over 65K.
Okay. So I feel like that's a conversation for a different day. I tend to agree a lot with Stephanie Kelton. She's a PhD economist who wrote a book on modern monetary theory. And we're actually seeing a real-time experiment of some of the theories, is that because U.S. debt is denominated in dollars that the U.S. controls, they can't run out of money. And we're actually seeing that real time. It's like, we just passed a $2 trillion stimulus. Like, they are kind of just printing the money, and we don't know how this is gonna play out, where we get this natural experiment, it's like, we don't need the tax revenues to line up with the spending. It's like, they really just spent $2 trillion. And like that, they kind of came out of nowhere. So it's a longer conversation about how the U.S., when it, because it pays for things in its own currency, is not constrained by tax revenues or deficits.
Yeah, that is one advantage for the U.S., which we've been taking advantage of. I'd like to say at our detriment. I'm not a big believer in huge debts. Even though if we can, doesn't mean we should. But that is a different conversation. But the simple math and calculus I just mentioned, again, wouldn't add anything to the debt. It's just redistributing the way taxes work. Now, it should be brought up that you could fund some of this with debt, but I'm just saying you don't necessarily need to, and nor should you. The other thing about debt, and again, larger conversation, is one thing that we need to keep in mind is how much debt we have compared to how much GDP we have. And
yes,
that ratio has been kind of under control. It's been less than 100%, but if that gets higher, we might get into a situation where our free lunch comes back to haunt us. But again, bigger conversation, perhaps, for another day.
That does feel like, we got to get into our debt service ratio. Okay, so we'll put that off to the side. So I'm a little curious then. I can see it decreasing the bureaucracy. And so like your example of, if you don't have to spend 2 days per year dealing with insurance, or that 8 to 16 hours per year, then you can increase the entire country's GDP. And this is similar to that if they're not spending time navigating these programs. But it does sound like a lot of the things we're trying to help with are already there. So like Medicaid already exists, and food stamps exist, and there's public housing, and a lot of these are already, I want to say, good programs. They are keeping or trying to keep people afloat in different aspects, and it sounds like we're just changing or getting rid of the bureaucracy and letting people decide how to use their own money. I'm curious where you think that benefit comes from.
Yeah, I think it does come from reducing bureaucracy. I mean, I think there's some part of being human that maybe it's in the back of our minds, or maybe it's hidden away, but we kind of hate giving people something for free. So we want to put them through a little bit of pain. And that's where maybe some of this bureaucracy comes from. But the notion is, it may not be helping. It just may be making the system inefficient. It takes a lot of overhead, not only for an individual to figure out these programs, but for the government to manage them. You actually need people to figure out the accounting for this. You need a huge staff at the IRS to figure out to make sure everybody's following the rules. You need to make sure that people are able to sign up and process these applications for these things and follow up every now and then to make sure it's all fair and balanced. That's a lot of overhead where you don't really need to worry about with a UBI. And the other way I'd also pull it into efficiency is that, for example, there was a pilot program in Colorado where they noticed that if they gave housing to homeless people, just because they don't have housing, here's a place to live, that ended up being less than having them be homeless on the street.
Can you go into more depth on that?
Yeah. So the notion is, if you're homeless, you're actually pulling a lot of resources from policing and from having to end up in jail for small recidivism and just other concerns, just because you don't have a roof over your head. And again, it's hard to get a job if you don't have that address. So again, maybe it doesn't feel nice to give something away for free, but it can actually save you, the citizen, money by doing so. So that could be true with UBI. It could actually be better for society. And again, these are things that can be tested. no reason to take my word from it. These are things that are testable. So I'd say let's check it out.
I do keep coming back to that incentives idea that, and maybe this is tied to the other conversations we had, like if you had this basic income, what are the incentives to be a contributing member of society? And it is maybe like on the happiness meaning aspect, because if someone's just living off the UBI and they're not contributing anything, they might be going down that just pure happiness and not have any meaning. So I think that's what it is. I think it's not a problem with giving someone something for free. It's that feeling that it's wasted. That feeling that if I give my child a new toy, it's like, you know what, they've been good this week, I'm happy with them, and they immediately break it. They didn't have the toy beforehand. They don't have the toy 10 minutes later. So their life is kind of the same, but I feel mad that they squandered this gift. Maybe that's the feeling. They squandered this gift, and I don't know how to address that feeling. It's because I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people, especially it would not surprise me if the majority of the U.S. population felt this way.
Yeah, you're probably right. I feel this way when you the way you say that. And here I am trying to advocate, or not advocate, or just put a view out for it. But I'd say I'd put it down to this. Would you feel any different if you knew that overall the average person would be better?
So I think my feeling is, I know there are enough people that are having really hard times. They're spending too much of their time dealing with health insurance and all these programs, and they have a family illness, or they are trying to work two jobs. I know there are these issues, and trying to make it easier for them appeals to me. And I think it's like the idea that negative income tax almost appeals more. But, and I know the theories of UBI, and I've seen pretty good, compelling research on this. And my hope would be that the people who don't want to make more money, they want to stop and smell the roses. They want to be closer on that, farther on that less materialistic path, that they're producing art. That's my almost naive dream, that they're still producing something and trying to be productive for themselves. I'm okay with monks living as monks and trying to give back in other ways, but I worry about society and like how many people are just going to sit on the couch watching Netflix.
Yeah, it's a concern. One counter, again, this all needs to be tested, but it could be true that, you know, we've mentioned that happiness increases with income up to a certain point.
Yep.
Well, if UBI is below that point, then that might be the incentive for individuals to go beyond UBI, meaning you may not be living the happiest life you could, and the average person may start to realize that and bump their income up to that point where they are happier. And again, that could be at an income higher than what the UBI would provide. That might be thing one. Just there's no, that's just a gut feeling at this point of what might happen. The other counter I'd also say is we mentioned that the United States and the globe, frankly, is going through this secular change where industries are changing so quickly and automation is coming into play and a lot of workers are going to just be displaced. And these are people who are used to working where we've even mentioned now, the best they can do is leave the workplace or drop down to a job where they're underemployed just to keep food on the table.
Yeah.
Well, there's plenty of reasons why UBI might be better in this case. It might allow an individual or a group of people who have been displaced to find or re-educate work more seamlessly. than having to go through the current bureaucratic process that we have today. So I'd say we have a lot of things that look like UBI, maybe, kind of, sort of, but it just seems like it's like the healthcare example we put forward where, yeah, if you get hurt in the U.S., you can get your health taken care of, but in the most inefficient way possible by going to the emergency room. Well, it kind of seems like that with some of these social programs where there just may be a simpler way to go about it.
That's interesting. That the job displacement by robots and software, I think, is probably the most compelling thing to me. We've talked about, like, the truck driver is not going to exist in a generation. So every person who is a truck driver, maybe with a scale of 10 to 20 years, if they're in their 50s, they're probably just going to retire. If they're in their 40s or younger, they might need some other kind of re-education, and they don't necessarily have the money to pay for that education. So I like that kind of thing. It's not just the truck driver. There's going to be many, many other examples we can't imagine yet, but that is going to become much, much bigger. My kind of last incentives thing, when we look at, like, lottery winners, people who just have this large sum of money, we know that the majority of them lose all of it and are back to where they were before. It's definitely, like, doesn't change their happiness level, but too many lottery winners go bankrupt. Is there a kind of mechanical difference between giving them a lump sum and giving them that monthly income? Or is the kind of result or the kind of lack of incentives still there?
I think I'd say it's been a while since I've quoted Warren Buffett, but this is something we had mentioned before, where Buffett's goal for his children is to provide with them with enough money so that they can do anything, but not so much that they won't do anything.
Okay.
So the notion is, yeah, it should be enough to get by, but not enough so that you don't do nothing. And that's what the lottery ticket tends to do, or the lottery winnings tend to do, versus what a UBI might do.
Okay. So we're trying to find that level where they're not going to go broke. They don't have to worry about the bank overdraft fees and healthcare and spending 2 to 4 days per year navigating these programs, but not enough so that there's still that still incentive to work a little bit more, increase their education, and try to increase that happiness still exists.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it concisely.
Okay. I don't know if you've convinced. I came in, like, ready to be all in, but you know what? You have convinced me. More study is needed.
I think that's the point. A lot of this stuff we don't know, and part of it is it's tough because it's emotionally difficult to digest. But it's one of those things where, why not look into it? I think the thing that we can probably all agree upon, I hope, is that there is a problem with income inequality, that if things continue the way they are, it just seems like a intractable problem that needs some sort of solution. And I feel like maybe this might be worth checking out.
Okay. What's your optimistic take? If mine is that there'll be more artists with this, what's your optimistic take for society?
If something like this were to happen, I think it might be the bridge to advance society more for the next generation and thereafter. I think it might be the safety net that might help things so that we have even more innovation and higher growth in GDP than we would otherwise. That's my optimistic view.
Okay. I like that. That does give me the warm and fuzzies. It does make me feel happy.
This was a pretty neat conversation.
It was. I agree. It might be a little incomplete. We had to think of some more specifics, or have that modern monetary theory, how do you pay for it, conversation, which will be, as I think about it, a really dry economic conversation.
Maybe, yeah. I think the other can of worms this kind of opens is the whole way our taxes are set up to begin with. You know, maybe that's contributing to this inequality notion. As we mentioned, the difference between individuals who are able to grow their wealth with capital gains versus individuals who are meant to grow their wealth based upon income.
That's a good point. Yeah, we'll have to see if we go down the path.
Right.
Well, it was great talking to you today, Trishul. I appreciate your insight on UBI.
Well, thanks, Aaron. I enjoyed the conversation as well. And of course, if you liked what you heard, do give us a review or send us a message. And thanks, everybody, for listening.
Yeah, thanks. Bye. Okay.
Bye.
We appreciate you joining us today for this episode of the Mind Money Spectrum podcast. Be sure to visit mindmoneyspectrum.com to access the entire library of episodes. Remember, it's not black and white, but the wide spectrum of gray area where you get to pursue the freedoms you want in life. Opinions voiced in this material are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. All performance referenced is historical as no guarantee of future results. All indices are unmanaged and may not be invested in directly. Have a nice day.